Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, we're going to take you into the fascinating world of writing for television with Paul Robert Coyle, whose impressive Hollywood resume includes writing for such series as The Streets of San Francisco, Crazy Like a Fox, Jake and the Fat Man, all the way to Star Trek Voyager, Hercules, and Xena, Princess Warrior. His fascinating and entertaining memoir about his life and career is titled Swords, Starships, and Superheroes, From Star Trek to Xena to Hercules, A TV Writer's Life, Scripting the Stories of Heroes, published by Jacobs Brown Press.
I'm curious, for someone who has spent so much of their professional life writing, but not writing this kind of thing, how different did this feel? What kind of adventure did this feel like for you as a writer? And did you feel like you were, in a sense, utilizing entirely different writing skills, writing muscles, if you will?
Well, script writing is the only kind of writing I've really ever done. I mean, as a kid, I discovered scripts, script formats. A teacher at high school had some movie scripts. And as soon as I read them, I realized, so this is visual, you know, it's not a lot of fancy schmancy literature. Prior to that, of course, I'd been writing short stories and whatnot for school projects. So once I discovered the script format, I fell in love with it. And that's really the, until this book, I mean, this is kind of the only kind of writing that I've experienced.
Well, I really love the way you have told this story, and it's a wonderful story. Before we start at kind of the beginning of your own story, I would love to have you share the essence of the book's preface, which is such a neat story about a memorable moment for you that now is more than 20 years in the past, but a moment that clearly meant a lot to you, and I think it's a great way to start the book. Tell our listeners about the moment in your life and career that you describe in the book's preface.
Preface? Are you talking about the convention?
When I spoke
at the convention? Yeah, okay. It's funny. 20-plus years ago, I thought about writing a book, and my first take on the book would have been how to write for sci-fi and genre television, kind of a how-to book with excerpts of scripts and so forth, as opposed to my story. This became my memoir. But my original take on that story, I sat down and I kind of abandoned that after a while because too much of it had been done, and there's no trick to writing sci-fi or genre. The basic rules of drama apply. But I wrote that premise way back when, because I spoke at a sci-fi convention during the time I was on heavily involved with Hercules and Xena. We had a huge fan base, still have, but at that point, I would say we rivaled Star Trek with conventions around the country every weekend of the year. And they would fly me to different cities. And of course the actors, you know, had a great side benefit doing these conventions and getting paid well for them. But so I spoke at one in Santa Monica, California, the convention center, which holds, I think, 3,000 people. And I showed up that day and I went backstage and I had trouble getting in because I was running late and the door was locked and so forth. So I came in backstage. I didn't see the auditorium before I went out there. And I didn't know what to expect. And I was nervous, obviously, because I'm not used to being a public speaker. And this might have been the first convention I did at the time. And when I went out, there were every seat was packed in a 3,000 room auditorium. And I got a big, I'm not going to say a standing ovation, but I got very, you know, big applause. And so that really, you become a star in the world of genre television. The writers and producers, to some extent, become idolized by the fan base. And so I went out, and that was prior to that, I'd been writing cop and detective shows, and I never got that kind of, you know, we never had those kind of fans. We never had conventions for the kind of shows that I was writing, like Chips and so forth. So that became the preface of the book. And then I flashed back from there to my beginnings and what led me to that point and beyond.
Right.
I
love the way you described this moment when, and you had just gotten done saying that you were expecting at the most polite applause from these mostly sure. young fans of this series. And then you write, "My name is announced. I step on stage to the accompaniment of the Xena theme to applause, big applause, thundering, even overwhelming. 100 flashbulbs go off. I look over my shoulder. Are Kevin and Lucy standing behind me, waving to the crowd? Everyone is applauding, not just politely, enthusiastically, wildly, for a writer, for me." And I think that's so interesting because I think some of us who live and work far away from Hollywood kind of assume that everybody who lives in Hollywood, in a sense, is a star, even if you're not an actor or actress on the screen. But if you have any part of Hollywood, I think we tend to think of all of you as part of the same universe and enjoying the same adulation. And this preface reminds us that for writers, it's a really different kind of fame. Maybe fame is not even the right word for that.
No, and it still isn't. I'm not famous to the general public by any means, but within that world, you know, my name was known and writers toil in anonymity. I mean, I've never thought of being a television writer as being famous. Only if you become a Quentin Tarantino or maybe move on to director. But I got to soak in that small amount of adulation for a period of time, and it was fun.
We're speaking with Paul Robert Coyle, and we're talking about the memoir that he has written called Swords, Starships, and Superheroes from Star Trek to Xena to Hercules. It chronicles his experience in Hollywood as a writer on a number of different TV series, including those mentioned in the title of the book. In the first chapter, which you call the origin story, you tell us right off the bat that near and dear to your hearts was the world of comic books. And it's really here that you started making your first efforts at creating your own stories. Tell us more about kind of the spark of inspiration that the world of superhero comic books were for you.
Well, you know, I was a kid right there at the birth of the Marvel Age. Fantastic Four number one and Spider-Man and so forth. And I collected all those issues, many of which became huge collector's items. One of which I saw recently went on auction at $200,000. You know, my mother threw my entire collection out when I was a kid because the adults at the time didn't place any value on comic books. But I didn't know what went into the writing of a comic book. I didn't know what a comic book strip format looked like. But at one point I sat down and I wrote a short story for Thor, Marvel's character Thor. And I sent it to New York to the Marvel offices. And I got a nice reply back from Stan Lee, Mr. Marvel himself. It was a rejection, obviously, but it was a very encouraging, letter to a kid to keep at it, keep pursuing a career. And I wish I had that letter to this day. Unfortunately, it went out the door with the comics that were thrown out at a certain point. Yes, comic books were a heavy influence at the time. Superheroes and then the television offshoots, the Adventures of Superman series when I was a kid and so forth. And ultimately that kind of segued into science fiction when Star Trek came along. But comic books, I grew out of them in a sense. I know a lot of adults don't, and I still love, cherish the memory of them. I haven't followed them for years, but there's still a big world of comic books and graphic novels now. And maybe I should get back into that at this point.
By happy coincidence, the room in which I'm recording this interview with you via Zoom, I had close at hand a couple of examples of little comic books that I wrote and drew when I was a youngster. I'm just showing it to you in the camera. This is My favorite was the Legion of Superheroes, and I always misspelled it. The Legoin of Superheroes. I couldn't spell Legion, but my cousin did the same thing, and he found a couple of my comic books from, you know, when I was a really, really little kid. But I'm just curious, did you ever attempt to create your own comics with the pictures, or were you drawn immediately to the matter of the story itself? Is that what you wanted to create?
Yeah, the story. I didn't draw comics. I did, however, draw a school newspaper when I was in grade school. And I remember I would draw a daily thing with cartoons and little parody articles and so forth. But I never considered I'm not artistically inclined in terms of drawing. So no, that wasn't the attraction. The stories were the attraction.
Right.
And of course, literature. Not that I was ignoring Steinbeck and so forth. Of course, I read that too. But comic books, the world of comic books and the stories they told were very involving to me as a kid.
It sounds like a really important person in your life was one Brother Philip Bergeron at LaSalle Communication Arts, and a class that you took from him towards the end of your time there that really made a difference. I love the way you describe this experience, and it kind of helps us understand the way in which it probably helped propel you, at least to some extent, into the life you ended up pursuing. Just tell our listeners just a little bit about this important formative experience for you.
Sure. Well, this was a Catholic high school, LaSalle Academy in Providence, Rhode Island. I grew up in Providence, born and raised, okay, so I went to Catholic schools all my life. And in the sophomore and senior years of LaSalle, Brother Philip taught a class called Communication Arts. We'd make little 8mm films of our own and write scripts for them and study films. He would screen important films like On the Waterfront or whatever, and we would discuss them. And Brother Philip is the one who had a collection of movie scripts like The Graduate and Bonnie and Clyde, I think, at the time. And so he really turned me on to that style of writing. And other than that, LaSalle was, Providence, Rhode Island was not a training ground for future Hollywood people. That was kind of an unheard of thing. The students at LaSalle went on to become doctors or lawyers or politicians. I had my own career trajectory and my own interests. And Brother Philip encouraged those. And I started writing, during that time, I started writing spec television scripts, written on speculation for TV shows of the period, like Bonanza and so forth. And Brother Philip would read them and encourage me to do that. Mm-hmm. So that was my path. And I would send those scripts to Hollywood, and I got some interest back. And so that encouraged me to say, all right, well, I'm coming up on the end of high school. What am I going to do? I'm either going to stay in Providence and go to college in Providence and probably follow a career path to become a fireman like my father and my uncle, or I can move to Hollywood and really give this a shot. And so I enrolled in a college class in Los Angeles and a writing class taught by Dorothy Fontana, who had been story editor on the original Star Trek. And right after graduation, I took a Greyhound bus and I came to Hollywood and never look back.
Hmm. I wonder if you would tell our listeners about a response that you got back to one of these spec scripts from somebody who turned that spec script down flat, but who added a little word of encouragement and, in a sense, an invitation, which you interpreted as a very literal invitation. And I mean, what ends up happening when you finally arrive in Hollywood is a really great twist to the story.
Well, there was a show, a long-running show on television called Death Valley Days, and it'd been on radio going back 20 years. The television series began in 1952, the same year that I was born. So at this point in late 60s, I read an article in a Writer's Digest magazine where they had a monthly writing for television column, and they interviewed a writer named Ann Udell, who was story editor on Death Valley Days, the Western anthology. Ronald Reagan had been host of the show for a few years. And in this article, she was saying how they were open to submissions from anybody. You didn't have to come through an agent or a lawyer. They would read them if you went to the trouble to write them and send them in. So I did, and I went to the library in Providence, and I researched stories of the Old West, and I kept writing them. And the show had been on 20 years, so inevitably what I was doing was covering stories that I had already done 10, 12, 14 years ago. And she would send me these notes, again, turning the submissions down, but encouraging me, saying this is good work. You know, if you have another one, I'd be open to reading it. And then at a certain point, and I'm talking, I did 10 or 12 of these. And she kind of said, oh, if you're ever in Hollywood, I'd like to meet you. This was about the same time when I was thinking about moving to, you know, to coming to college in Los Angeles. So that was a gold-plated invitation. So when I did move to Hollywood, I called her up, and she invited me up to their offices on Sunset Strip. And right then, after 20 years, the Death Valley Days had just been canceled, and they were getting ready to vacate the offices. So the timing was off, but I thanked her. It was one of the part of the impetus that got me here. So we went our separate ways, and that was that. But
Well, in a way, it ended unhappily, in some ways happily, because it got you to Hollywood.
Yes.
And it also, in a sense, kept you from going down the road of Westerns, and instead maybe allowed you to go down a road which turned out to be much more exciting and ultimately profitable for you. You've already mentioned the name of Dorothy Fontana. For any of us who love Star Trek, we know that name well. She looms large in terms of being a very important part of that story, that show. Tell us more about her writing class, which you tell us was everything you had dreamed of. So it sounds like she knew what she was doing, not only as a writer, but also as someone to teach this to other people.
Yes. Well, remember, she wrote a lot more than the Star Trek. She had written for the Westerns, were very big at the time. So she wrote for Bonanza and Lancer and various other shows. So I knew her name, not only from Star Trek, but from a lot of television shows. There weren't that many women writers at the time. So, and she wrote under the name D.C. Fontana. So for a lot of years, a lot of people didn't even know she was a woman. I think I did at the time. I'm not even certain. But I found out, you know, when I was researching colleges in Los Angeles and what teachers were offering what kind of writing courses, when I saw her name, I immediately, you know, that perked my interest. And this was a writing for television course, not a writing for Star Trek per se, but how to write for television. And it was a once a week night course. So that I signed up for that course, and I took that course for 2 years. And she was an amazing teacher. And she'd have guest speakers, not every week necessarily, but Gene Roddenberry came one time, and a lot of big name television writers would come to talk to us. Hmm. And of course, we would write our own scripts. It's where I learned about pitching. You don't get a job in Hollywood unless you go in and verbally pitch a story to a producer first. I didn't know that when I was writing these spec scripts. I figured this must be how it's done. You just write a script and send it in, and they produce it. Well, that's not the way it's done at all. You learn to pitch a story, and that's a kind of an acting technique. In one sense, it really has nothing to do with writing. It's more of a performance kind of situation. Hmm. But we got to practice pitching in her class, pitching to her or to each other, and then following through with that pitch and writing an outline and then ultimately a script. So this was a terrific course. Hmm. And one night Roddenberry spoke, and he took a bunch of us out to the House of Pancakes afterwards. So that went on for 2 years. And then toward the end of that period, the animated Star Trek came about. The original had been canceled a few years earlier, but there was still big fan interest, so they were making this animated series. And somehow I landed an assignment, kind of as a result of an outgrowth of that class, of being a student in that class. The assignment might have even begun in the class. I don't exactly remember that, but I got an official assignment to write for the new Star Trek animated series, which was Saturday mornings, I think, on NBC, Filmation Studios. And I wrote an outline, and then you have a meeting, and you get notes, and then you rewrite the outline. And then the next, I was told to wait, the next thing you do is you wait for an official pickup to write the script. And I got paid for the outline. This was an official thing. And I waited and I waited. And at this point, the school year ended, so I wasn't seeing Dorothy on a weekly basis anymore. But what happened next was and I went to a convention, a very early kind of a sci-fi convention at the Ambassador Hotel. And there was a panel devoted to Star Trek, the animated show. Dorothy was not there. I don't remember who was on stage, but somebody announced the names of writers who had been hired for this new animated show, and mine was one of the names. And this was during the period I had turned in the revised outline, and I was waiting for a go-ahead to write the script. So that got me all excited. So what I did was I went ahead and I wrote the script without them telling me to, and I sent it in, and the next thing I get is a rejection. Roddenberry decided to kill the story, as happens, you know, for whatever reason, he decided not to do that story. And now they were refusing to pay me for the script. So that was what began as an exhilarating high. I came crashing down to earth when I got this rejection. And I told everybody, oh, I'm an official, I'm a writer now. I'm making a living as a writer. So that was a kind of a heartbreaking experience at the time. But looking back on it now, it makes an interesting anecdote, right? But at the time, it was really devastating to me.
Right. In a sense, it helped you understand that the specifics of the process really matter. And maybe the way the wheels turn in Hollywood and the succession of steps that need to be followed, and they really need to be followed carefully. And when somebody disregards them, even out of naive ignorance, nevertheless, it in a sense gets you in trouble.
Yeah, I got in trouble, but I was 20 years old at the time. I was a 20-year-old kid. I was not an experienced writer. They could have given me a phone call to say they decided against doing the story, but they didn't. They kind of left me hanging. So I was a little, I was certainly bitter about it for a while, and then I never watched that animated show. I couldn't bring myself to watch it. I must have thrown that script out because I can't find it in my files, so I don't even have a record of it. But years later, it makes an interesting story, I think. It's important to write about the failures. And you're writing a book about writing for television, it's not all one success after the next.
Right. Before we get to your successes, I want to give you a chance to just touch at least briefly on one other, in a sense, screw-up early on, just because I think this is an amazing story as well. This is when you were given the opportunity to be an intern for the old, I think, ABC show, The Mod Squad, about three undercover cops. And we didn't get ABC in my little town in Iowa when this show was on, so I only saw this show years and years and years later. But it's a really iconic show from the era, and you were able to be an intern. And with the best of intentions, you ended up really stepping on some toes. And I won't use the language that you use in the book to describe just how badly you kind of screwed things up for yourself. But at least touch on the essence of this story. Again, it's really interesting. And it reminds us about what it's like to be young and in Hollywood and not yet quite knowing what you're doing.
Yeah, you're really touching on the low points of my life.
Yeah, so far. We'll get to the successes in a second.
Right. Anyway, so the Mod Squad experience, that backs up even a little bit before the animated Star Trek. I was still in college. This was the first year of college. And unbeknownst to me, my teachers submitted my name to the Television Academy's annual student internship program, where not just writers, but anybody interested in television. So I was called in for a meeting, and they said, What would you like? I want to be a writer. And I guess they had read some spec scripts I had written. And I said, they said, what shows might you be interested in? And we'll contact the producers of those shows and see if we can get you an internship. And Mod Squad was a big hit show at the time. And that was at the top of my list. And maybe I mentioned a few others, but they almost immediately contacted the producer of Mod Squad and got me that internship for the summer at Paramount Studios. What that meant was I got to go and sit in on meetings and writers' meetings and casting sessions, and got to go on the set whenever I wanted to. and just observe. It was not an internship as we know them today, where you'd make coffee or make Xerox copies or whatever. Nothing. They weren't asking me to do anything. I was there as a fly on the wall as an observer. All right. So, but of course, I wanted, you know, I was interested in writing. And so I'm reading all these scripts and I'm hearing all these writers come in and take their meetings. And I'm thinking, well, you know, I could do this, I had opinions. I had strong opinions. So what I just started doing was I didn't verbally interject those opinions in the middle of meetings, but I wrote up some notes and left them on the producer's desk. And that was, believe me, that was the wrong thing to do, because he didn't take that in the spirit that it was intended. He thought I was overstepping my bounds and being rude. And I was also inexperienced in social situations. I just didn't come off well. And they basically, that whole thing turned into a disaster. And one day in the screening room, watching dailies, Milton Berle, who had been guest starring in the show, didn't like it, and he didn't know who I was, and so he had somebody come over and kick me out of the screening room. So this incredible experience of being able to come to the show every day turned into another disaster. So, and yet, I learned through osmosis by being around these people and reading all the scripts and just seeing all these meetings, I learned an incredible amount. But it was too much too soon. I think I wasn't prepared for that kind of experience. So it turned out badly, and yet I benefited from it.
We're speaking with Paul Robert Coyle. We're talking about his memoir, Swords, Sardships, and Superheroes, From Star Trek to Xena to Hercules. It's a chronicle of his long and fascinating career as a writer in Hollywood. Well, let's turn to happier matters. And really, in some respects, the launching of your success as a writer came with the show The Streets of San Francisco with Carl Malden and Michael Douglas. And what's really interesting is you kind of tell us about, I think it's the first script that you sold for them, that at the end of this pitch session, you thank them, and they very politely thank you instead. I mean, and say basically that you were helping them out of a real jam. And it's kind of interesting to think about a world in which that would be possible, and a nearly completely unknown writer saves the day for a show like The Streets of San Francisco. Explain that.
Let me just say that you mentioned that was a pitch. That was not a pitch. That was a spec script that I wrote. After the Star Trek experience, all right, college ended. So now what was I going to do? So I got some odd jobs, and I ended up as a security guard at a movie studio in the overnight shift. And I was able to write, I spent every night writing spec scripts for television, and I had an agent who was submitting them to producers. This went on for a year or two. And one of the scripts that I wrote during that period was for Streets of San Francisco, the hit ABC show. And the producers read it, and they responded nicely, but they were already full up for that season. So they were basically turning it down, but they said maybe next year. All right, a little time went by, not long, but a couple months maybe. And then the next thing I know, they called back, and they were buying it. Another script that they had ready to shoot the following week fell through or didn't measure up in their eyes to mine, and they remembered mine, and so they bought it and shot it a week later, almost word for word as I had written it. So I had a meeting, then I went in and had a meeting with them to meet them and say hi and thank you. They didn't need anything from me. Whatever production rewrites they needed, they were doing themselves. But that's the meeting where they thanked me for writing the script, and what, you know, they paid me what was a huge amount of money for me at the time. So, and in fact, I got a second assignment for that show. Ultimately, the show was canceled after 5 years before my second script got made. But the first one got made and was very successful, and that led to other assignments. So, that was a great beginning. Streets of San Francisco, to this day, is a well-remembered, well-respected show. The year I wrote it, it was nominated for an Emmy for Best Dramatic Series. Very successful, very classy show of its time. Mm. So, yeah.
As you wrote then for a succession of different shows, I mean, either getting scripts on the air or at least submitting them for
And you know, some of these shows we've probably not thought of in a long time, like Simon and Simon and Barnaby Jones and Chips and Crazy Like a Fox, with which you had quite a long tenure, and so on, and Jake and the Fat Man, starring William Conrad. As you would go from show to show, what kind of challenge was it to, in a sense, find the personality of those particular characters in that particular show? Or when we're talking about these kind of shows, is there not quite that distinctiveness in terms of what character X sounds like versus character Y in show X or show Y? I mean, I think that's probably a more subtle matter than it might be in other cases where you have to try to write authentically for a character like, for instance, Mr. Spock.
Well, in those days, all television shows, all episodic shows were mostly written by freelance writers. Writers would come in to do a script 1 week, and then they'd go move on to another show. So they would do three or four different shows within a given season, maybe multiple scripts per show. Nowadays, that's not the case. They're all staff written, with very little freelance input. But in those days, you would go from show to show. So the best you could do, you'd watch the show, of course, but sometimes the show wasn't on the air yet. It's just beginning. So they would send you the scripts to read. So you try to capture the voice of that show. And if you're unsuccessful, the producer will rewrite it themselves. So in the end, they'll adjust it to the voices that they want. But if you are successful, that tends to lead to, further assignments on that same show. If you do a good job for them, then it's a lot easier to get a second assignment on a given show than it is to get the first one. First one's always you got to jump through all the hoops and you got to have the meetings and the disappointments and so forth. And once you deliver a script that is successful for them, they're after you. All right, we need another one. Can you do another one next week? And that's the sweet position to be in. But that was the life of a television freelance writer through the 70s and 80s. And that was what I craved. I loved being a freelance writer, coming in, doing a quick job on something, getting paid for it, and then moving on to something else.
When you began stepping into the world of science fiction and fantasy in a real way, how different did that feel? I think this is kind of like my first question today about what's it like to write a memoir versus what is it like to write a TV script? Are they totally different things? When it comes to writing for Hercules, The Legendary Journeys versus Jake the Fat Man or The Streets of San Francisco, is it pretty much the same exploit for you artistically and technically, or does it feel like you're on a different planet in a sense? I mean, as a writer, doing a really different kind of writing.
No, I would say, I mean, if I was writing sitcoms, that's a different type of writing. But the experience of writing and going in and meeting with a producer it doesn't matter whether it's a cop or a detective show or a medical show or a lawyer show or a science fiction show. And along the lines, I wrote for, I worked with Mike Piller on Simon Simon, a comedy detective show. And later he came on to Star Trek and he brought me out of those Star Trek. So I was working with a guy I already knew from a different genre altogether. The experience of going into the office and meeting with these people and talking story, is a universal one. It kind of doesn't matter what the nature of the show is. Now, when you talk about the show itself, some people don't like sci-fi, or they don't feel that they're well suited to it, or they're not suited to westerns or whatever. Or others can do all different kinds of formats. I mean, I did the ones that we talked about, cops and detectives and sci-fi and swords and sorcery. I never did medical shows or legal shows. I mean, not that I couldn't have, possibly, but I wasn't drawn to that style of television. But the ones that I mean, there were all kinds of shows, and sci-fi was a drawn. I started with a superhero interest, and that drew me to Star Trek, and that in turn evolved into Hercules and Xena, Swords and Sorcery. So it was a continuous journey. jumping from different shows, but the experience of writing them was pretty similar no matter what show you're going to.
Right.
You just have different relationships with different producers.
You mentioned in your book that when it comes to Xena, Warrior Princess, when you were approached about the possibility of writing for that show, you actually passed. If I remember correctly, you basically thought of Xena and Hercules as kiddie shows or whatever, and they really didn't appeal to you, at least in the abstract. Tell us what ultimately changed your mind about that.
Well, I did turn down Xena when it was first, I had some producer friends who knew the producer of Xena, which was a new show at the time, it wasn't on the air yet, and he was looking for writers, and they said, would you like us to put in a word for you? And I said no, because, well, I didn't understand what the show was, and the title, Xena Warrior Princess, sounded ridiculous to me. And at that time, I was writing for Star Trek Deep Space Nine and Voyager, so I was doing quote-unquote serious science fiction, and I thought those kids' shows, they just didn't seem up my alley. By the way, around the same time, I turned down X-Files. I turned down an introduction to the producer of X-Files, which was just getting off the ground, because again, that didn't sound like the kind of show I wanted to do. But in the case of Xena, I started watching it after, you know, after 6 months or so, the show premiered, and I didn't pay it any attention at first. And I watched a few minutes 1 week. Oh, here's a show that that I had an open door invitation to, but let me check it out. And I watched a few minutes, and it seemed silly, and I turned it off. And the next week, I watched a few more minutes, and I kind of got hooked. And then the next week, I watched an entire episode, and I started really getting into it. And I called them, and I said, you know, a year has gone by, but they're about to go into a second season. I wonder if the door might still be open. So I went calling back, and luckily I was able to get in that door and went on from there. It could have been X-Files. I might have pursued the X-Files too, and that might have led down a different road. But Hercules and Xena... I did a bunch of Xenas, and then that led to Hercules, which was the original show that Xena had spun off of. So that was Sam Raimi and Rob Tappert, the executive producers, and then I ended up on staff over there. So that was a very intense 3 or 4 year period for me.
Right. One thing that is intriguing, I think, to think about the writer who has the challenge of coming up with a new, fresh story that also fits into continuity. I always think that balancing act in and of itself is really pretty tricky. But also the fact that the sense we get is that sometimes you have, in a sense, completely blank slate, and you just need to come up with something, whatever it is. And then at other points, you need to come up with something that really serves a purpose behind being a good script for Hercules or a good script for Xena or a good script for Star Trek, that sometimes there's a big arc in which something has to plug in, or they have something they want to have happen to a particular character, and you have to supply a script that sort of serves that intention. Can you just talk about the difference between those two kinds of experiences as a writer?
Well, for an ongoing show like Xena or Hercules, or any show, you have to tell a given story in a week with a beginning, middle, and end. But sometimes the series itself has an overarching storyline going, or they're telling sometimes a serialized story. That's more and more the case nowadays. But at the time of Hercules and Xena, to begin with, the stories were mostly self-contained and had mostly come from the world of Greek mythology, Atlas and Zeus and so forth. And then they had run dry on those. And what I started doing is bringing sci-fi concepts like time travel and alternate dimensions to that world, because those did not really come out of Greek mythology. So in that sense, I came at the right time when they needed to open up, and I was thinking outside the box and from their thinking. So that's the way it worked on that show. For any show, you go in and you pitch a story, and they'll take elements of it, and they say, well, all right, but it works for us if we do it this way instead of the way originally. So they will shape the story that you come into the office to tell. And if you end up doing that, they'll call you back and they'll say, all right, well, this is the direction we're taking it in. And if, you know, if you need to adapt, if you're not comfortable with that and insist on doing it your way, you're not going to get very far in the world of television. You have to make compromises and work with the staffs of these shows.
Hmm. One thing you touch on in your book brought to mind an experience I had when I was privileged to actually interview Kevin Sorbo, who portrayed Hercules on this series for which you wrote so extensively. His memoir goes into something that you also talk about in your book, Swords, Starships, and Superheroes, namely the very serious health setback which he experienced, which changed the whole nature of what he was physically capable of doing. And here he is, the headliner of this flagship program, really, really popular, and wanting to go forward with it, as did everybody else associated with the show. Just briefly tell our listeners just a little bit about this important moment in the history of the show and what this meant for you and your fellow writers.
Right. Well, what happened was Kevin had a series of mini strokes, an aneurysm. And this happened, by the way, not on a set of Hercules. We shot in New Zealand. But it happened when he was on hiatus. He was in Los Angeles. And prior to that, I had met him. I had finally gone to New Zealand. I was already on staff at Hercules. So I went to New Zealand. I met him for the last show before the production hiatus. This was shortly before his medical crisis. So he ended up in the hospital, and it was, and he writes about it in his book called True Strength. He came very close to having to have his arm surgically removed. And he was out. We had an emergency meeting to, what are we going to do? Well, we can't shut down. You can't shut down a show in the middle of production and put hundreds of people both in Hollywood and New Zealand out of work. So we had to continue on doing the show without Kevin Sorbo, without our star. And gradually the hope was that he would be able to come back, which he did, but it was over the period of a year. And he came back a little bit at a time, but we had to do a series of shows without him altogether. How do we do that? Well, we do a flashback to young Hercules, and we have another actor playing in that role. We had a great supporting cast on the show of actors like Bruce Campbell and Michael Hurst, who could take the lead in a given episode. We would have Lucy Lawless come over from Xena and do a guest shot to carry an episode. We would do what's called a clip show, where we'd have a reason to show clips from previous episodes that Kevin was actually in. So we struggled to do the show. You know, Hercus turned into a Porcules. He's turned into a pig one week. So we do his voice only. That's how we continued doing the show for the rest of the season. And luckily, Kevin did come back to strength slowly. By the time he came back to New Zealand in the beginning, he could work, maybe an hour a day. And then after a few weeks, he worked 2 to 3 hours a day. So we had, write him very lightly in episodes, and he couldn't do a lot of movement. So we'd rely more on stunt doubles and photo doubles and so forth. But gradually, he did come back to full strength. And that's how we carried on. And I actually think that was one of the most creative experiences in my life. Having to struggle to do a show called Hercules without being able to rely on the character of Hercules. Hmm. They weren't all gems that we did during that period, but I think we did some very fun, creative stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and including an episode. Yeah.
And I think you and your colleagues should be really proud for what you came up with in an incredibly difficult situation. A last question, and I want to reiterate that your book is chock full of all kinds of stories that date from your years with Xena and Hercules and so on, and lots of ups, a couple of downs, but really interesting, and other projects that ultimately never saw the light of day, but were also a part of your life. You certainly tell us that the world of Hollywood and writing for television has changed dramatically, especially changed from the days when you got started. Just briefly explain how different this world is now, and in particular, how differently it operates when it comes to aspiring writers.
Right. Well, it's changed in every way. I just said what I said a few minutes ago about being able to make a living as a freelance writer going from show to show. That is impossible nowadays. Directors can do that. But writers, you're either on staff or you're out in the cold, and they hire large staffs. A show can have a staff of 8 or 9 writers, and if some of them are teams, that's even more bodies. And all these bodies are in the room at meetings. Nowadays, they're all Zoom meetings. But you cannot make a living as a freelance writer. Maybe one episode a year will go to a freelancer. So it's changed in that sense. It's changed also in the sense that some shows are more and more serialized. Shows are more tech-oriented. Cop shows became like CSI, where you need to work with a technical consultant to get all the jargon, the techno-babble that goes into a given episode. It's also in the sense of, how does a writer get started? Well, you write spec scripts. That still is true. However, in the days that I was talking about, writing Death Valley Days, The Streets of San Francisco, the producers of those shows would actually read those scripts and sometimes would buy them, as happened in my case. Nowadays, the lawyers won't let the producer of a given show read scripts that were written specifically for that show. They're too afraid of being sued by the writers. If the producers go ahead and do a similar idea, the writer will think they're ripped off. So it's totally out of the question that a producer will read a spec script for their show. However, they might read a script of another show as a sample. So you can sit down and write an NCIS, for instance, but the producers of NCIS are never going to read that. They're not allowed to. But the producer of some other show might read it, and based on the writing style, might agree to have you come in and pitch. Or a lot of times you don't even pay. You go on staff. They hire writers nowadays without them even having written an episode of the show prior to that. And a lot of them don't work out, but they're hired and they have a contract. They're there for 6 months or whatever. And they're in a room with 10 other people, so it's hard to make an impression. But that's the way television works nowadays. It's, wow. Every show has a showrunner, and that person is the head writer. And then they'll have a staff, and they'll assign all the episodes to the staff. All right, you're gonna do the third episode. You're up, and then you'll recycle, and then you'll do episode 8 and so forth. So one writer will be assigned a certain number of scripts per season, and they'll still have to come up with the stories for those episodes. But again, the writer will pitch, or the producers will already have ideas of what they want to do. So that's the way shows are written now. They're staff written. They're not freelance written. But it's still writers making a living. There's still a lot of writers employed. So there's still a lot of good shows on television. A lot of people think television is better than ever. So it's just my stories are the way it happened to me. And I've always been interested in reading other people's anecdotes about things that happened to them. But anybody starting out today, it's going to be different for them. They're going to have their own stories to tell in 30 or 40 years.
Absolutely. In the meantime, your stories are fascinating, and it's a fascinating look at, in a sense, a Hollywood that no longer exists in this same way. Your book again is titled Swords, Starships, and Superheroes, From Star Trek to Xena to Hercules, A TV Writer's Life, Scripting the Stories of Heroes, published by Jacobs Brown Press. Paul Robert Coyle, I really enjoyed your book, start to finish, and I enjoyed this opportunity to speak with you on The Morning Show. Thank you so much for giving the world this interesting book and for being part of The Morning Show today.
Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll be previewing a couple of really exciting holiday offerings that are coming up within the next few days. First of all, Kenosha Unified's Ye Olde English Christmas Feast, that splendid holiday tradition. It is still happening this year, albeit, of course, under very different circumstances. And we'll be speaking with Polly Amborn, John Che, and Brian Lynch, who all have a very direct hand in this year's feast. Also, a preview of a wonderful Christmas offering from the Racine Theater Guild, which will be shared with the public this weekend. It's the latest in their Spotlight Signature Concert Series, I'll Be Home for Christmas. We'll speak with Doug Instanis and Jocelyn Fish on the staff of the Racine Theater Guild about all that it took to put together this Christmas extravaganza, which will be shared with the public this Friday night. It's exactly 9 o'clock. Support for the morning show comes from Carthy.